This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we explore how to cope with the stresses and strains of caregiving. Plus, we'll learn how a simple device can cure a common foot problem. But first, how an encouraging word from a teacher can go a long way to improve student performance. Well, statistics show that as a group, Black and Hispanic students don't achieve as well in school nationwide as white students. And some of that achievement gap can be attributed to family poverty and some to fewer resources. But some recent studies have found that a simple method to improve trust between teachers and students can improve performance. And here with more on this is Dr. Rich O'Neill, psychologist and researcher at Upstate Medical University, and Sharon Contreras, the superintendent for the Syracuse City School District. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having
me. To be here.
So, Rich, help us understand what these statistics are actually indicating. What are they and what are they showing us?
Well, it's actually a whole series of studies. The notion of what we call stereotype threat came about in about the 1990s. That if you're a member of a group that has negative stereotypes about it, that that's a threatening experience for you, and it actually impedes performance on in school and on standardized tests, et cetera. So it's so automatic and profound, for instance, that the simple act of indicating before you take some standardized test that you're of a certain stereotyped group, you check a box that says your race, then you will perform less well than if you don't have to check that box, because automatic and unconscious, also true for women, for instance, in physics exams. So if women are reminded of their gender before they take a physics exam, they're going to do less well than if they are not reminded of their
gender. And it's because of this so-called stereotype threat, they feel threatened and therefore are more anxious potentially?
Yes, probably anxiety. People don't really understand the mechanism yet, but one of the theories is that what happens is when you feel that threat, your working memory and concentration are impaired somewhat, so you're not able to use it as well on the task at hand. Mm-hmm. And then if you remove that threat, then you perform better again. Your brain is back to full capacity.
Do you think the ramifications of this also leads to things like higher dropout rates, for example, in school?
Yeah, I would imagine it does. That I know some of the research, and we can talk about that, has shown that if you buffer kids against the negative effects of stereotypes, that they actually perform better in the short term, but also in the long term. Some wonderful research showing this in middle schools as well as college.
Well, I want to get specifically to the research in a minute, but what role do you think that a teacher's perception or expectation may also play in this?
Expectations are very strong. They're, you know, in our society, the stereotype says Black and Latino kids won't do as well. So they can be, that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it's pervasive. The research shows that that's true for teachers as well as parents, as well as the kids themselves. We're talking about these pervasive stereotypes, and they are, you know, they become part of us, and they're certainly part of our society. And what this research is showing, oh yeah, they have a very negative effect on kids' performance. But you can do something simple. You don't have to change the whole society. That was what's so amazing about this research to me when I first started to read it. They make small interventions that have a profound effect over a number of years.
And long-lasting, as you've said.
And long-lasting, yeah.
So how is the lower expectation communicated? I mean, I think that's a crucial thing. Is it body language? Are things actually said? Is it the way feedback is given? How is this negative stereotype communicated, if it exists at all? What do you see, Sharon Contreras?
Some of the things, or the ways in which this plays out, is in the type of assignments that are giving, not giving very high-level assignments because one may not believe they can handle that. So you'll hear a teacher, and this is all over the country, it's not something specific to Syracuse, say, well, that's too difficult for that student, or for this group of students, so I have to take them where they are instead of pushing them harder, or it might be something like allowing them to sleep in class, saying, well, I bet, you know, they worked all night long when they may not have worked. They may just be sleeping in your class and not waking them up.
So you're saying that there are preconceived notions, much like this idea of stereotypes, that affect the way the teacher views the student and they communicate it, either subtly or directly.
Oh, absolutely. Not just teachers, all of us. So, for example, we are told constantly that students in urban school districts come from poverty, and if we just had more money, it could resolve those issues. So the problem then resides outside of us as the educators, or the solutions reside outside of the educators. So we start internalizing this. Well, maybe I can't overcome this reading problem that the student is having because, you know, the student is poor. They come from a poor family. Well, if we start believing that, we believe less that we are empowered or have the skill to help a student become a strong reader, a strong mathematician.
So what
and that the student has the capacity in them to do that, to perform at a higher level.
That's
so it
right.
feeds on each other.
And also what I'm hearing is that there's a sense of, in some cases, mistrust from the student, perhaps, and maybe negative expectations on both sides that can feed into this entire kind of academic environment.
Yeah, I don't think that's as blatant as one might think. I think that it's all very subtle, and I think it's because a student might pick up that you don't believe I can do this, not because the teacher has somehow communicated, I don't trust you, I don't believe in you, but you haven't firmly stated your belief that you can do it, little Sharon, you know, little Mark, whatever. You haven't made that comment to them, I believe in you, I expect nothing less than you, and I'm going to help you.
And that is the segue to the research, because
that's one of the very exciting pieces of research showed that if you assign kids a writing task and then gave them feedback on that task, either by saying, yeah, we're giving you this feedback and we expect you to do better, or you say to the kids, we're giving you feedback, we expect you to do better, and I know you can do it. That simple message from the teacher to the student, the kids responded very positively to that. So the split on the kids who got the I know you can do it, I think it was about 80% of those kids revised their essays spontaneously, whereas only about 20% of the kids who didn't get that message revised their essays. Those kids also reported subsequently more trust in their relationship with the teacher. So they didn't think, I'm getting this feedback because I'm Black or Hispanic. I'm getting this feedback because I know you have this capacity and I know you can do better. That increased performance. They not only revised their essays, but they got higher grades. That stayed with them for a number of years. So it was very significant. It raised it about, on a GPA scale of 4, about 0.3. So about like from a B to a B+. So it was a significant effect just from that very small intervention.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here along with psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill and Syracuse City School Superintendent Sharon Contreras. And we're talking about how low expectations on the part of teachers can often play a role in children's performance. So obviously what we've just said is that the reverse is true. High expectations with a sense of belief in the child's ability to succeed really can raise their performance.
And communicating that to the kids. And I just want to say one more thing about that study. That same intervention didn't work for white kids because they don't live in the stereotype. It did work for Black and Hispanic kids. So it was having a differential impact and counteracting that stereotype threat.
Right. And much of what Black and Hispanic Latino students or their perception of themselves they learn or they perceive comes from outside of school. So yes. It's advertisement, what they see in the media. When you don't see Black and Latino doctors on the television shows, in the movies, everything you see about yourself is negative. And then it also plays out in school. School is just a microcosm of a much larger society. So to what you're saying, Dr. O'Neill, it would likely only work with Black and Latinos or with women, for example, because they have picked up or we have picked up on these stereotypes about ourselves outside of schools, and then they play out inside of the schools when a teacher is working with us in a classroom and we're trying to perform. And sometimes I see that students don't even try anymore. They don't believe. They have given up. They do not believe. And then you have a conflict. The teacher saying, please do your assignment. And they think the student is just being obstinate when the student believes they cannot do it. So they will just be disruptive. I can't do this assignment and we'll do nothing. And then you have a conflict in the classroom.
Mm. How do you turn that around, though? How do you encourage the kids to, I mean, you're saying that this was done.
That message was from this research was exactly addresses that. The kid doesn't believe it. And they expect that any criticism to be negative and not use the criticism. The kids who got this message, yeah, I have high expectations, and I know you can do it. They actually use the feedback, so the communication from the teacher was taken in.
Yeah. So, but I think that's the critical point.
Yes.
That in those research studies, the information was absorbed. I mean, the fact that they believed in the student was absorbed, and I think that's obviously where the rubber meets the road. They need to believe that this teacher is being genuine and that they do believe in them.
Absolutely. You know, I was a principal outside of Chicago. And the school was low performing when I took that school over. And the teachers didn't necessarily believe the school could be high performing, not because they disliked the children. They loved those children. I could see it in their eyes and in their commitment every day. But they hadn't had that experience with success, with the students mm-hmm, having success. Mm-hmm. And we started talking to the children about their ability to go to college. These were elementary students and how smart they are. And they started seeing an increase in student performance. Once they saw the increase, the teachers were sold on this, as were the teachers, and as were the students, and they started expecting a lot more from the students and not accepting, you know, mediocre work from them and telling them constantly, we believe you can do this. And it turned the school around. Mm-hmm. So high expectations really matter. This study, I think, is specific to higher education, but certainly there are similar studies in K-12 education, or 4K-12 education, yes, about high expectations.
Some of this was done with middle school kids, actually.
Oh, okay.
And then
wonderful.
Also some research done with college students,
yes,
finding very similar things that their performance increased if they were buffered against the stereotype threat very early on.
And it sounds to me that the combination of high expectations and communicating to the individual student that the teacher believes in them and that they can perform at a higher level are kind of the crucial combination.
Yes. And then when you have the parents telling the students that as well, you have a recipe for success. You know, I only know success. My brothers and sisters only know success. People are amazed that we all went on to college. And, you know, there are 8 of us biologically. We all went on to college.
Wow.
Have advanced degrees.
But you're saying that because you're Latino?
And Black.
And black
a woman.
And uh-huh.
But my parents told us, you are smart. I mean, from the time I was, I can remember walking, you are smart. You were going to college. I thought I was in kindergarten to go to college. That's what I believed, that I'm going to kindergarten to go to college.
Wow.
So that was in your genes.
It was,
yes. That was down in your cells.
Right. Uh-huh. And sometimes I talk to parents and they say, well, I wasn't good in math either, so he won't be good in math. I said, there's no math gene. It's not biological.
That's right. That's
you
right.
know, but wow. they, so I'm sure it's not just what's happening in schools. You have parents who don't tell children that they believe in them and that they are smart and can achieve anything.
So that's the takeaway, it seems to me. Would you agree that it's not only the teachers and the schools clearly need to do it, but the parents need to do it as well? Would you say that's true if you talk to parents In terms of your role now in the Syracuse City Schools, what do you see in terms of parents' involvement and that whole?
I think parents do what they are able to do, and that we have to engage them far more, but in ways that they can and are willing to be engaged. So if you expect every parent to be a PTO mom, they're not going to be a PTO mom or dad. Yeah. You have to engage them in the ways that they can be supportive to you. But all of us, the educators, the parents alike, we have to express to children that we believe in them and they can achieve. And I think that we will start seeing success.
Yeah, it sounds like that. If that's done on a daily basis, in a way, it sounds like you can't lose. Would you agree?
I agree.
Based on the research?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming in. My guests have been psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill and Syracuse City School Superintendent Sharon Contreras. Thanks so much. This is very inspiring information.
It is inspiring.
As you said, small affirmations regularly stated can really kind of change a child's life.
Absolutely.
Sounds to me. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, coping with being a caregiver. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. Caregiving can be extremely rewarding, but the pressure of caring for someone who is elderly or has a chronic illness can also lead to stress and feelings of frustration, anger, and even guilt. We'll hear with more on this and how to cope is Michael Close. He's a social worker with Hospice of Central New York. Welcome, Michael. Thanks for coming.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So caregivers are at risk for certain emotional and physical reactions just by virtue of the fact that they are a caregiver. Tell us about that.
Well, they are, mainly due to the fact that they may not have prepared to be in the role that they're currently find themselves in, being that primary caregiver. Easily remedied by a little pre-planning, perhaps. Thought, conversation, having open and honest conversations with your parent, your spouse, your children, whoever it is that you find yourself caregiving for.
Most of the time that comes on suddenly often to become a caregiver, though. Or often it does.
Very suddenly, yes.
So what you're suggesting is most of us don't think about preparing for this kind of thing.
Correct. In our culture today, we prepare for so many other things. You know, we have insurance for so many things out there, car insurance, health insurance, but we don't really take into consideration long-term care.
That someday some one of us will have to be a caregiver in some respect.
We may have to be.
So, but the whole notion of being a caregiver can lead to certain emotional reactions. It seems understandable in a way. Mm-hmm. Tell us about what you see.
Well, what I see quite often are people kind of getting ahead of themselves, thinking that they can do everything themselves.
As
the caregiver, not being prepared to be the only person that is going to be there providing 24-hour support, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. They're not really emotionally or physically prepared to be that long-term caregiver.
So what do you say when you talk about preparation? What can someone do to prepare?
What you can do to prepare to be a more effective caregiver is some pre-planning. And you hear that term out in the community every once in a while, pre-planning for arrangements. What I mean when I say pre-planning is having an open and honest conversation with you, your spouse, your parent.
In terms of what your wishes might be, where you want to be, how you want to be treated, those kinds of things.
Your wishes, your healthcare desires. In the medical field, we call them advanced directives. They're very important, and most people address those after they become ill, but really it's something that needs attention even now at 40, 50, 60 years old, catastrophic illness and even injury aren't something that we know often that they're coming tomorrow. So we have to have that plan put in place before we get ill or injured.
And things like the healthcare proxy and the living will and all of those, that paperwork really should be in place.
Absolutely.
And should be something that family members discuss with each other.
Absolutely. It should be an open and honest conversation with your whole family so everybody's on the same page.
So I've heard the term caregiver burnout. What do we mean when we say that?
Well, as I mentioned before, you know, it's just taking on a little bit more than you were expecting and not really being prepared for that 24 hours a day, 365 days a year of meeting somebody's needs wholly.
Other than your own.
Other than your own. And usually when we're having this conversation, we're not talking about, you know, a 10-pound baby. It's more of a 200-pound grown adult, which has more of a physical need there.
And it sounds to me like it can actually affect your own body's immune system, that kind of stress, and perhaps even lead to illness.
Absolutely. Caregiver stress is a very serious topic. It could lead to loss of appetite, loss of sleep, increased depression, increased anxiety, and all of those things when you're not taking care of yourself. We talk about this a lot, self-awareness, self-care. It's a conversation I have daily with folks, you know, taking care of themselves, being aware of their own body and their own needs. When you're paying attention, so much attention to somebody else's needs, you quite often overlook your own.
Yeah, I think that is the most common thing.
Absolutely. And it's also very common in the healthcare field as well. With everyone focusing on everyone else's needs, you kind of forget about yourself.
So what are some of the other ways that you need to become prepared? You said you need to get some of the legal advice so that you understand kind of what your legal responsibilities are and what the person's wishes are legally as well.
Absolutely. The advanced directives is a big point that needs to be addressed before someone gets ill or injured. Another beneficial task would be to review all of your insurances to see if you have Medicare or commercial insurance, what exactly they're going to cover. If you have a long-term care policy, that would definitely need to be addressed and reviewed early. Other benefits from the state, the county level, the federal level, VA benefits if that's appropriate.
So basically, you really got to get all your ducks in a row, so to speak.
Absolutely.
All your paperwork clear.
Yeah.
Well, let's get back to this whole idea of recognizing as a caregiver if you should have caregiver burnout or stress. And some of the signs that you've already recognized, mm-hmm. you would notice if you're having headache pain or stomach pain or things that are happening that you may not normally experience.
Right.
You need to begin to recognize this and then what can you do? What do you recommend people do? Because quite often they can't relieve themselves of the responsibility.
That's right. Well, a few things that you could do is surround yourself by identifying multiple caregivers for backup. So if I'm the primary caregiver, that first person who's going to be there 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, that you have multiple people who can come in and sit with your loved one for 2 or 3 hours so you can get out to your own doctor's appointments, so you can get out to perhaps a support group, to meetings, or just to, you know, go out to have lunch with friends or to the park for a walk. You really need to be kind of aware of all the things that kind of surround you.
So that old adage that we talk about, actually that came from the airline industry, you know, is to put the oxygen mask on yourself first before you can help someone else. You really need to recognize what your needs are and try to find ways to meet them.
Absolutely. It's a great analogy.
Maintain yourself. So I read somewhere that things, first of all, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Hospice of Central New York social worker Michael Close. And we're talking about coping with caregiving, which is really quite a significant issue for many, many people these days as people are living longer and we're being asked to take care of our loved ones. What are some of the ways? I mean, I read somewhere that things like relaxation techniques are really important. Do you help some of your clients with that, learning some specific techniques, for example, to minimize the stress that builds up during the day?
Usually by the time I get involved, we're more towards the end of caregiving, but with some folks that have been in it, you know, for the long term, try to identify other options that they have. Again, you know, support groups, backup plans, other people that can come in and help. And there's plenty of programs out there at the county level.
Yeah, I might add that the County Department of Aging and Youth, I know, has a Caregiver Resources Center. Mm-hmm. They have a telephone number, 435-2362. That's area code 315. And also they developed an eye care institute, which is for caregivers. And they have classes that they give, mm-hmm. you know, throughout the year for people to get together and talk about some of their issues with caregiving. Yes. So that's a good resource as well.
Yep.
And tell us, when you say you get involved usually toward the very end of life, through the
Correct.
Hospice.
Yes.
But are there special issues that occur more then for the caregiver than would happen maybe early on in the process?
Yes, just because the your loved one, the individual who's physically going through the medical direction that they're going in, the end of life care, they have more emotional needs and physical needs, which bring up more emotional needs for the caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just kind of identifying that. And then they get so entranced in the caregiving for months or years, that's all coming to an end. And it's kind of all coming to a realization. And now you have 24 hours a day where you don't have somebody to care for.
Especially if a person's been moved perhaps to a facility after mm-hmm. you've been the primary person taking care of them. I would imagine that alone could also bring up feelings of loneliness, guilt, even depression.
Guilt and depression and anxiety are all very big.
Especially
emotional.
Even more so, you think, toward the end.
That's where they all kind of come to a head. You know, it all kind of comes up and, you know, depending on how long you were a caregiver, if you were a caregiver for years, and now that's, you're starting to realize and see signs that it's coming to an end, you could possibly have more of those triggers that we were speaking of.
And so what do you recommend people actually seek? Psychiatric help, psychological treatment? You as a social worker, do you spend time actually doing therapeutic work with caregivers?
If it's appropriate, absolutely. You know, the psychiatric care would be very specialized if there was a psychiatric need, severe depression, dysthymia. Social workers are a great resource at hospice. We have the Center for Living with Loss. So after your loved one passes away, for 13 months after that loss, you can actually come into hospice and have ongoing supportive counseling.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yes, it's a great resource.
Yes, that's really wonderful.
And it's free.
It's free,
it
wow.
Is, yeah. It's part of the program.
Can you tell us the number at Hospice of Central New York?
The telephone number at Hospice of Central New York is 315-634-1100.
Okay. That's very important, I think, for people to know, because especially as we enter the holiday season, going into the holiday season and beyond, it seems to me, in general, there's a lot of expectations for it being a joyful time. And if we're in a situation in our lives that's not as wonderful as we might hope,
mm-hmm.
it would seem that, I mean, a lot of people are coping with emotional feelings during this time. So I know that knowing that there's a resource, especially if you are a caregiver, to find some support and hope is really very helpful.
Absolutely.
Also, this idea of respite services, when you mentioned people need to have time to get away.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the Department of Aging and Youth and the Caregiver Resource Center does have information about different types of respite care. But do you recommend that people really have an opportunity to get away from this experience on a somewhat regular basis if they can?
That's a case-by-case basis. I promote that everybody plans for it, that at least you make yourself aware that it's out there, what the requirements are for you to meet their specific requirements, because every program out there, whether it be covered by your insurance or commercial, they're going to have their different criteria and different requirements. And early on, I like to find out what exactly what criteria you meet, what position where we could find a backup plan for each individual patient.
So that you might be able to get some support that
Absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, this is very, very helpful information. I think a lot of people out there these days are have become caregivers. Many of us, myself in particular, have it on both sides. I mean, you know, we can often be that sandwich generation.
And that's right.
Do you find that women are more often in that position? Or do you see it as pretty?
I think culturally, women tend to be more in that position.
So reaching out for help, putting the oxygen mask on yourself, finding those resources, and trying to realize that you can't do it all.
That's right.
Is what I'm hearing you say.
Absolutely. Really, and recognizing that ahead of time.
Ahead of time.
Making the plan. Forward thinking.
Be prepared. Yes. That's what I'm hearing you say. Well, thank you so very much. My guest has been Michael Close. He's a social worker at Hospice of Central New York. I thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I am registered dietitian Terry Podolak with Healthy Eats. And this week, we're talking about New Year's resolutions. My overall recommendation is to include more whole food, plant-based, versus processed foods for your health. Eliminate fast foods and keep it simple. The following are 14 tips for 2014 to help you with your whole foods resolution for all year long. Take time out and slow down. Prepare a mindful meal with friends and family at least once per week at home. It helps to plan ahead to be less stressful. Set a nice table and keep dining out for special occasions. Say a prayer of gratitude before meals. Take a Whole Foods cooking class and plan a vegetarian potluck in the new year. Eat seasonal and local. Be inspired and read Animal Vegetable Miracle by Barbara Kingsolver. She includes her family recipes and how she managed to eat seasonally and locally all year long. Learn and visit organic farms. The Ithaca Farmers Market is open all year long and is a great field trip. Keep grocery shopping simple, including label reading. Look at the list of ingredients. If it's too long and complicated, I wouldn't purchase the item. Strive for 3 fruits daily, including berries, and strive for half a plate of vegetables and include kale, collards, and spinach. Meet with a registered dietitian if confused, especially if struggling with weight issues or diabetes. Don't overcomplicate things or do quick fixes. Seek stress reduction programs if needed. Try meditating. Even at 5 minutes daily, set a timer, or seek meditations online. Try some new grains, such as barley. If gluten-sensitive, try millet or teff. Eat foods with magnesium, such as beans and greens and nuts, even blackstrap molasses, which is a great healthy replacement for sugar. Walk 10,000 steps daily with friends to keep up your strength and get the support needed. Be active with starting a garden in the spring. Honor your hunger and your fullness. Plan snacks ahead so you're not grabbing at the last minute when you're really overhungry. If poor digestion, try probiotics to keep the healthy bacteria in the gut and the toxic bacteria out. Have good sleep habits. It helps you to have better energy level and clearer thinking to make better whole food choices. The lack of sleep kicks up the need for energy foods and cravings. And last, stay positive. Do the best you can. It's progress, not perfection. Think back to nature for feeling better and meeting your health needs. This has been Terry Podolak wishing you a happy new year of healthy eating.
Next up, how a simple device can cure a common foot problem. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
I'm Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for December 30th. Keep Monday on your mind. Congratulations on a full year of healthy habits. Even if you still have a ways to go on your goals, now's the time to celebrate all of your progress. As you look to the coming year, Think about this weekly habits worked best for you and the areas where you could have used a little extra help. Remember to check in with yourself every Monday to stay accountable and see results. This week, think about what has worked for you in the past and what you'd like to achieve in 2014. Set your resolution and determine the steps you need to take to be successful. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Well, foot pain is an extremely common problem, but evaluating and diagnosing it can be daunting because of the wide array of conditions that can cause discomfort. And while the exact prevalence rates in the general population aren't really known, some small studies have suggested rates between 30% and 80%. Well, joining us with more on this subject is Dr. Christopher Neville. He's Associate Professor of Physical Therapy at Upstate's College of Health Professions. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, foot and ankle pain, it's quite a common problem, I guess.
It is.
Tell us about it.
There's really a range of things that can cause foot and ankle pain, and then it's amazing how debilitating people can be due to their foot pain. So,
how many in the general population that you've seen or know about, what would you say? Do you think the prevalence is more like 30 or more up to 80%?
Well, you know, one of the things that's also very interesting about foot pain is that people manage it on their own, and probably lots of people have foot pain. And what do most people do that have foot pain? Well, they go get new shoes, or they, you know, maybe go see their primary care physician, but really probably lots of people are managing foot pain, but they're managing it kind of on their own.
Right.
I would say most people that I see, by the time I see them, they really have really bad foot pain that they've had for a long time.
Really? Yeah. I mean, especially with all the ads for Dr. Scholl's and things
of that nature,
I think people often think of it as something that they can provide a home remedy for.
Sure.
So what are some of the potential causes that you think that are out there for both foot and ankle pain?
Well, there's really a range, and it probably depends a lot on age, too. There's lots of kids with foot pain. But then as we get into, young adults and then even older adults, for sure, what do we know of the most common ones? Well, plantar fasciitis is a huge one.
So plantar fasciitis, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Plantar heel pain is a really common source or, cause of foot pain. That if you ask the general public, maybe even many people have probably experienced it sometime throughout their life.
What causes that?
So the plantar fascia is a fibrous band that's on the bottom of your foot, and it maintains, we know mechanically it maintains some of the structure of your foot. But, in our culture, we spend a lot of time on our feet. We spend a lot of time walking around, and we put a lot of stress on that structure. So it gets inflamed, or it may start to degenerate, and that's what causes pain.
So that's basically, it's an inflammation of the fascia.
Well, yeah, there's even some new data that says it doesn't quite, it may not be inflammation, it may be sort of a degenerative reparative response.
Mm-hmm. How about things like women wearing high heels? Do you think that contributes a lot to the kind of issue of foot pain? I mean, especially now, these days, I mean, you're looking at heels of 4 inches up.
No,
I can't even imagine it.
It's interesting.
I break an ankle
myself.
We
look at footwear across our culture. It's pretty amazing. But, again, there's so many so many causes of foot pain. As we look towards the forefoot and toes and bunions and things like that, we probably see the shoe wear and high heels and pointy shoes and things like that is probably a really more contributing to foot pain in areas like that.
How about athletes? I would think they would be very at risk for foot pain.
Sure, yeah. I mean, soccer players and things like that are always hard to treat because they like their to stick their feet in really small shoes.
Yeah, I remember when my boys were playing soccer, the idea was to get a shoe that was two sizes smaller than you would normally
stretch it out.
I never quite understood that. Fortunately, they didn't suffer long-term injury, but it's a pretty scary thing. So tell us about treatment in general for foot pain. I mean, what is the general sense of treatment?
Yeah, I mean, and treatment really ranges. I mean, if we talk across clinical care, I mean, there's we mentioned already off-the-shelf kind of things, and there's lots out there. People, really great shoes, and then also just off-the-shelf kind of orthotics and things like that.
So when you say really great shoes, is there a rule of thumb in terms of, being fitted properly? I mean, these days is not like I remember. Now, I'm mm-hmm. getting up there in years, but it used to be you'd go to a shoe store and someone would really fit you mm-hmm. with a shoe. Mm-hmm. And these days you're buying off the internet or you're going into warehouses and mm-hmm. you're buying shoes, you know, at Marshall's or mm-hmm. whatever. Mm-hmm. And so no one's there to really tell you this is a good fit for you.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point just in that, you know, the data on shoe wear and modifications to shoes, we really have struggled to find the exact changes that we can make to shoes that then impact how the mechanics of your foot change. And so a lot of sort of the recommendations on shoe wear have really come back to sort of saying what is comfortable to you. If you go in and you put on a pair of shoes and it really isn't that comfortable, it's probably not the right shoe for you.
So comfort should rule in a sense.
In many cases it may, just because this idea of having shoes that are anti-pronation shoes or if your foot is too supinated and so you should be in this type of shoe. In many cases those shoes don't match up to what is going to be comfortable to you anyway.
So really you will almost have to let comfort be your guide is what I'm hearing.
It has to be one of the factors for sure.
As opposed to style, which often is very uncomfortable.
Yeah, or just fitting into one of these, like if you have a flatter foot or a pronated foot or someone tells you you have a pronated foot, then you should only wear, you know, certain types of shoes. That may not always be the case.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, and I'm here with Upstate physical therapist Christopher Neville, and we're talking about that common foot the common disorder of foot pain and treatments for it. Now, I understand that you are involved in a study to examine the best conservative treatment for a very common foot disorder, flat feet, which you just alluded to a moment ago. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so flat feet, although in many cases we identify flat feet as a problem, it's really not a problem. It's actually quite normal, and if you look across, you know, the population, lots of people have flatter feet or flat feet, and it never bothers them at all.
I'm one of them.
It's okay. Right?
I always felt so odd about that, though, because so many people I would know growing up had these beautiful arches, and I'd have this very flat foot.
Yeah, but it's really okay. When it's not okay is that there are certain conditions that cause flat feet. So if you're foot, one foot, or both feet collapse, and then you should get that seen. You know, you should be seen to see.
So they become flat. In other words, they don't start out as flat feet, but they somehow flatten, is what you're
saying. Or they get flatter. Mm-hmm. And if you see things like that happening, that those there can be reasons that happens, and you should get it treated sooner rather than later.
And what is the term for that?
Well, one of the conditions that causes an acquired flat foot is posterior tibial tendon dysfunction.
What does that mean?
And what that is it's a degeneration of one of the tendons in your ankle. This tendon we've discovered it has a pretty primary role in kind of the mechanics of how your foot works. So if it starts to degenerate, it changes a lot about the structure of your foot, and then also sort of more globally just in how your whole mechanics work for walking. And things like that.
And I read somewhere that it can happen either from an acute injury, like in a fall, or maybe overuse, but also other risk factors can play a role, like diabetes or obesity or hypertension.
Yeah, we really see that just as sort of the characteristics of people that have this problem typically are, you know, over 40 years of age, more sedentary in their lifestyle, maybe have hypertension, diabetes, things like that. It's usually not an acute injury of any kind. Many times people will come in sort of relating it to, I remember stepping off of a curb or doing something. But really the degenerative process takes a long time. It's been occurring for probably a long time. There may be just one event that you remember.
So what's the goal of your study? What are you trying to accomplish?
Well, so this problem has been around for a little while, but it's relatively young in the you know, fields of research. So we have very little data to suggest, you know, what is good care for this problem. Most of it has been in surgery, so there's lots of surgical care for it. And it's very successful for the right person.
But obviously not for all.
That's right, not for everyone. And so what we're trying to do is look at some of the conservative care options. Conservative care has been widely recommended.
Give us an example of when we say conservative care, as opposed to surgery.
Yeah, so that usually includes physical therapy or exercise in some way. But then also orthotics are bracing, and that's been really a pivotal piece in the conservative care arena, is what are the braces, what are the orthotics that you can use, and are they successful?
So is that what your study is attempting to do?
Yeah, this study is really targeting, trying to understand what are the components of the braces, how are they designed, and then do they work?
So what will you be doing exactly?
So what we're looking at is we're looking at four common braces that are used for this problem, and we're evaluating each of those four. And we're evaluating them not specifically for those exact four braces, but these braces represent kind of the different types that are out there. And
I see.
We're looking at the components in them and their design.
So you need people to participate in this study right now?
We do. So people with posterior tibial tendon dysfunction that that are seeking care, they can be enrolled in the study, and then they're provided braces.
Yeah, are there other considerations in terms of the people? And they have to be a certain age, sex?
Yeah, they do have to be over 40, and this is more commonly seen. Most studies have about 80% women in the study, but you don't. It can be either men or women, but you have to be over 40, and that's mostly just to exclude the sort of younger runner population, high school athletes who can get similar kinds of pain, but it's really sort of a different problem.
So you want to control your population.
Yeah, like all research, right? We control it a little bit.
So what will the study participants be asked to do?
So what they're going to be asked to do is come in a few times, and what we're going to do is make, cast and fit for these braces. So we'll make some of these braces and then have them wear them. We'll have you wear each of the braces that we make while you walk in the lab, and that's the part of the study where we're looking to see how these braces work. And then you're going to be randomly assigned one of the braces. You wear one of the braces for 12 weeks, and then at the end, we see how you did.
So basically, you're attempting to, as you said, evaluate the effectiveness of one particular style of brace over another in terms of treatment.
Yeah, part of it is to look at the mechanics of how they work, and then part of it is to look at the effectiveness of them at the end.
Yeah. So how long will this take place? I mean, what period of time?
This is an NIH-funded study over 4 years, and we're in about a year and a half right now, so we're almost halfway.
But you still
need a little ways to go.
You still need more participants.
We sure do.
Well, how do people get involved if they want to?
So it's a clinical trial run through Upstate, and you can call the lab. We have a phone number or an email.
I saw a phone number for the Upstate Motion Analysis Laboratory at 464-9966. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so then people will also have more information on our website about it. But the point here is that you're looking for people. It's free to them. They get an opportunity to get some really good treatment and figure out get a solution to a problem that's much wider.
Yeah,
sounds
for
like.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Christopher Neville, Associate Professor of Physical Therapy at Upstate's College of Health Professions. Thanks, Chris. I wish you the best of luck with your study.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hello, this is Deirdre Nealon, editor of The Healing Muse, with today's selection. We often tell our medical students that as they prepare for a career as a physician, as a professional, that it's so important for them to listen to their patients talk. I have a poem I'd like to read today in which a mother seeks to explain the autism of her son. Now, it's obvious that the physicians are the experts in autism, but I would also say the mother is the expert in her son, what she fears, what she feels. And I think when my med students read this poem, they have an insight into how autism feels. This is by Barbara Crooker. It's called Autism Poem Number 20, The Knot Garden. In my son's brain, sounds travel on a difficult journey through cortex and cerebellum, arrive with distortions, different clusters of word associations, as if they were travelers hacking their way through a hedge or a thicket in unknown territory. We're never certain that what we say arrives at the station on time, the train screeching its brakes, discharging passengers. Autism's a labyrinth of false twists and turnings, blind passageways, spirals that lead nowhere. Here, chevrons of geese wedge their way across the sky each autumn. They know where they are going, have purchased tickets marked south. Our route is more circuitous, two steps forward, one step back, a knot garden where the possibilities diminish as the years branch on. Too soon we'll arrive at the alpine altitudes where the vegetation's scarce, the flowers tiny but exquisite, the foliage barely visible.
For joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we discover how your fitness level can predict your true age, plus how music therapy can truly heal the soul. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, all one word, .org. And if you want to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.